Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome, everybody. Good morning, Baltimore. Good morning, Maryland. Good morning, America. Good to have you all here with us. We start our new time slot, 9 to 11 a.m., following Amy Goodman, of course, and her wonderful program, and then before that, the Baltimore Blend joins us at 6 a.m., and when we leave here at 11, Michelle Martin's back on the air with us to tell me more of my favorite show on NPR, so all that's coming up in the course of the day, and we want you to stay here with us on WEAA. We're really happy to be here in the mornings. So if you're awake at your desk, you can email us at steinershow@gmail.com. Jump on Facebook, hit Twitter at Mark Steiner, give us your thoughts, questions, and ideas. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com or call 410-319-8888. On our way to our conversation about Andres Alonso and his tenure as CEO of Baltimore City Schools, a couple things I want to say. When I listen to the news coming in and hear about this lotto thing being up to $300 million or whatever, my first thought always is, how come we don't teach our people to save instead of just teach them how to gamble? Maybe we'll do that in a couple of days from now. We'll have a conversation about that, see how that might work. At any rate, on the way to our conversation, I want to remind you about talk a bit about yesterday, Mother's Day. And Mother's Day, you know, we think of it as this holiday and a Hallmark card holiday. It means nothing but chocolates and flowers. But it really was a holiday that has radical American roots. It was a holiday to honor our mothers. There was a woman named Anna Jarvis in 1907 who followed the work of Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, was an abolitionist, a woman suffrage fighter. These were women who fought against poverty and for equal rights and wages for workers, blacks and whites in America. They organized this thing, a Mother's Day, to honor mothers and working mothers and organize poor women to fight for their rights. And that's the origins of Mother's Day. That's where it came from. And kind of forced Woodrow Wilson to declare Mother's Day, but it began long ago. And Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, wrote this poem that I want to read to you that spurred the Mother's Day battle during Reconstruction in the 1870s, when she was talking about black and white women together in America fighting for a new world. And she wrote this piece, and it said, "Arise then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts. Whether your baptism be of water or of tears, say firmly, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe away our dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil as the summons of war, let women leave all that may be left at home. For a great and earnest day of council, let them meet first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them solemnly take counsel with each other as to the means whereby the great human family can live in peace, each bearing after his own time the sacred impress, not of Caesar, but of God." And that began the battle for a Mother's Day. And Mother's Day work day clubs rose all across America and then forced the Mother's Day to honor women and their struggle for a better America. Those are the real roots of Mother's Day. So many of the holidays we have in America come out with our roots that come from a people's history, but we never talk about the people's history. We just talk about Hallmark cards. It's more about cards. It's more than about cards. It's about who we are as a people. Just try to share that with you. And we'll share little ditties like that every morning here on the new Mark Steiner Show, every morning to wake us up to our America. And we are joined here in studio. Erica Green is with us, who joined us last week by phone. She's education reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Erica, welcome. Good to have you in studio.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Ronnie Ellington's in the studio, associate professor of mathematics education here at Morgan State University School of Education and Urban Studies and coordinator of the graduate program in math and science education. Good to have you back with us, Dr. Ellington, always.
Thank you.
And Buzzy Hedelman's in the studio. Buzzy Hedelman, as a special education advocate, has been for years. He served on the Baltimore City School Board from 1971 to 1974. They brought him back for a second tour of duty in 2005. And he was part of the team that brought Dr. Alonso to Baltimore City. And I remember in the beginning when both he and Brian Morris, then chair of the board, were very excited about this new man they were bringing to town. And we'll talk a bit about that. He was former director of Baltimore City Social Services and former secretary of Human Resources in the state of Maryland and has been a social activist for a long time. And Buzzy, welcome. Good to have you back in the studio.
Thank you very much.
And you all can join us here, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, to join in on this conversation. So Dr. Andres Alonso came here, said he would stay at least 5 years. And he would try to stay 10, but he did stay 6. And that's longer, 3 years longer than most superintendents stay in any urban school system. And some people would argue by any measure, take that back, by any establishment measure, he has done a great job, some people would argue. Others would say that you have to look beyond those measures to figure out how we measure his success or non-success in our school system. So an overall report card. Let's start with Buzzy, since you were part of the team that brought him here in the first place. Let's begin with you, Buzz.
Well, first, thank you for the nice Mother's Day story. I feel like I'm in school. Great fun. I think that Baltimore is now at the head of the pack of urban education, but there's a long way to go to the finish line. And I think that Dr. Alonzo has put us there. I think he's changed the culture. If you look at urban schools across the country, we are doing at least as well as any. But again, we have a long way to go, and Dr. Alonzo himself says that. And so the question is, where do we go next? Who do we go there with? And it should continue to be a promising and exciting time for us. But we do have a long way to go.
Dr. Ellington, just a quick thought, then we'll get into some real specifics. I know you have a mixed bag of thoughts here.
I do. It's early, so let me get myself right. Well, one of the accomplishments.
That's why I appreciate so much you came in so early this
morning. Yeah, you know how I roll. It's interesting because I sit on many different spectrums of this particular issue. One, as a newly appointed member of the Parent Community Advisory Board, I'm actually one of Dr. Alonzo's appointees. In addition to that, being an educator, a parent, and a community person, and someone who's an advocate for teachers in my work in professional development and math education. So I'm looking at this in many different venues, if you will. So I hear he's done a good job, and I'm still trying to figure out how that's being measured. I get the test score conversation. I've been on your show several times discussing how I feel about that. And as a math educator, I tell people I can move test scores and I can move graduation rates by moving the game. I can do that. It's not that hard. That doesn't necessarily mean that the culture of Baltimore City schools are better. So I just want to leave that on the table, particularly for teachers who I feel have been the scapegoats and the, you know, casualties of what I call the Alonzo regime. And it was a regime. I mean, you know, when you have full power and you can pretty much make any kind of decision you want, that has implications for how the culture is created in Baltimore City schools. And I'm very interested to see how the culture will shift when the regime head is no longer there and how the house of cards will play themselves out. But what I will say about his accomplishments is, as a parent, I feel like this push for school choice and fair student funding in particular was one of his hallmark decisions, because I feel like in that there was a desire to really have more community support within education and give parents more choices. So that's what I would hail as his biggest accomplishments. Now, whether or not, you know, under his regime we're better, I really have my own issues with what people are using to measure that, particularly the graduation rate conversation, because as I feel, I can always increase graduation rates by just graduating more people, not necessarily more people that can actually do something beyond high school. So I'll give Alonzo credit for the choices, the intention. I think he was very much a strong leader for Baltimore City. But I think in that strength, it does come off, it did for me anyway, as a parent and talking to teachers, who, by the way, had no real permission to critique the regime, if you will, that there was a certain amount of fear and culture of intimidation that was created that I don't think people can really talk publicly about, because you know how that rolls. So that's my 2 cent mark early in the morning, and I'll leave it at that. I'll leave it at that.
Erica?
Well, she took a couple of my cents, but I would say, you know, for me, in talking to people in the last week or so, I've asked the question, you know, do you think the system is better than, you know, when he got here at this point? And Alonzo is a data man. He's definitely a data man. So when you talk about accomplishments, you know, you're looking at the stats, you're looking at the data and how it's moved over time. Underneath that, I think you know, again, we haven't really, as a reporter, I get to talk to people all the time, and they never show up in the paper, which is great because it gives me some context for that data. You know, I would say in the last, I would say, year and a half, something has been taking place in the district in terms of morale, and in terms of you know, this kind of what are we doing? Where are we going? I mean, even fair student funding, it really kicked a boost in the system. Mm-hmm. School choice boosted the system. But then we get to this point where, you know, even the school board and the budget discussions this year were kind of like, well, do we – should we do something else with this fair student funding? Should we be doing it this way? You know, the school choice reform, you know, charter started to come forward to air some of their grievances that maybe people had not seen before or heard before. So again, he's a data man, and in that respect, you know, that's undeniable that has moved in a positive direction. But again, I think, can it sustain when he leaves will be the true question of whether or not they were successful.
Go ahead, Buzz.
Well, I'd like to deal with the specifics, and you have a situation. Well, it's not enough to simply to say that we may be doing as well as anybody else, since no one is doing as well as we should. But then the question is, well, what do we do next? And as some of you know, I mean, I think that the focus now needs to be shifted to the classroom. It's about instruction. It's about instruction. It's about instruction. And there, I think that. That was never Dr. Alonzo's number one thing. The first school board meeting I was at privately, we had the conversation. He has always been a decentralization person. If you go back to the dissertation he wrote for his doctorate at Harvard, he talked about change coming from principals. And I think that's an important step. But as the saying goes, it's necessary but not sufficient. And we're going to have to strengthen the instructional infrastructure I keep talking about. Dr. Sonia Santelises is a terrific person as the chief academic officer. So I think he brought her here. So I think things are in place. And hopefully that will be the next emphasis. You can only do one or two big things in a big organization that's got lots and lots of problems and obstacles. And hopefully the classroom instruction will be the big thing that is the focus. And to some extent, decentralization needs to be modified to have that happen.
Well, let's talk about this for a moment. I mean, what is that in what you just said, Buzzy, and I'm curious what we think, what does that mean in terms of whether or not decentralization as a mainstay, as kind of as one of the cornerstones, I think, of Dr. Alonzo's work here in Baltimore, was that a success or failure? What did decentralization mean in terms of what real control did principals and teachers have in their classrooms in terms of how they teach and what they teach? Did that occur? And if what you're saying, Buzzy, was that now we have to shift to the classroom? I'm curious how we define that in terms of where have we been for the last 6 years? The last 20 years, last 6 years, if we're just talking about doing that, the shift to the classroom now, what does that mean? Well, let's just stop there. I'm just curious how this decentralization you think worked or didn't work, and how successful or unsuccessful was it, and what does it really mean to decentralize a city school?
Well, as a parent, I'm speaking as a parent now, not even as an educator. I've actually been at one of these. I used to be the vice president of PTA at Garrett Heights, and it was when it first came out, and we got a seat at the table with fair student funding, and we had all these meetings. And at the end of the day, what actually drove the budget was the numbers. And even though there was this notion that the principal had certain controls over monies, 85 to 90% of the monies were already accounted for. So, and as parent, you know, we're thinking we're at the table and we can say we want X and Y and Z, and the numbers just didn't support what we wanted. So I think the spirit of it, having other people at the table to really discuss what we want in our schools is a good idea. But the bottom line is a lot of these things that we thought we had control and say over, we just didn't. So, yeah, if you wanted some special activity and you only had $3 left after they paid all the people, I mean, what you, you, it was nowhere to go. So that's one piece. So I think the idea of having all these constituencies around the table when creating a budget for a school is a great idea. But again, there are constraints. And then also, let's talk about the principals. This is the very interesting dichotomy here. Alonzo was like, oh, yes, we want the principal control. But the principals are under fear of constantly being fired and constantly feeling like if they're not up to snuff, if you will, they would be eliminated. So you create this climate where you say principals are the leaders of the school, yet they don't feel comfortable in really giving themselves permission to do things that take time to do. It doesn't take a year to turn a school around for real, for real. You need time to really sit and reevaluate the culture, put in things in place. And as an educator, as a researcher, I know it takes 3 to 5 years to just see the results of any intervention. So I was really, I wasn't getting the whole, it's the principal. It, you know, we want to support the principal. It felt like to me from what principals told me off the record, because they definitely wouldn't say it on the record, that there was this pressure to do and be something that just was impossible. And they felt the fear constantly. And a lot of parents, principals left or were moved, et cetera. So I don't know if the climate, I don't think the climate created that experience for principals, although that was the intent.
I would say that the, you know, the decentralization model, it really has depended on what leader is in place in the school, whether or not it works. The more experienced principals loved it. Those who supported Fair Student Funding from the beginning, they loved it. But with 80% turnover, of course, you have a lot of new principals. You have a lot of principals who I think we do have a pool that is, you know, have significantly less experience.
Mm-hmm. And so turnover in principals in the last 6 years.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I wrote about that a lot.
I'm just kind of emphasizing the point.
It's been, you know, it's been a lot of turnover, and he's been unapologetic about that.
He has on this program as well.
That's, you know, that's okay. But whether or not, you know, a principal being able to kind of run a mini district, if you will, you know, the success is really varied. And another thing I'll say is something came to mind when I wrote the story about the temporary employees being cut as a result of a couple of things happening. You would not believe, I mean, 7 o'clock in the morning, I started getting phone calls from principals saying, oh my goodness, what am I going to do without these temps? I mean, they are the backbone, and I don't have to pay them as much as a full-time staff member. And a couple of them have had to get creative with that. But then, you know, I know principals who Fair Student Funding works mm-hmm. great for them. And another conversation the school board has been having in the last couple of months, or at least, I guess, in the last few weeks during this budget season is, you know, whether or not there's going to be enough support at the central office when this is all said and done. You know, cutting the central office is great, but you still need people who can run the district mm-hmm. and can support the 200 and some programs that you have. So
therein lie the contradictions, because people have always complained about North Avenue,
I know,
25th
exactly.
Street.
I know, yep.
Bureaucracy getting in the way.
But then they're like, oh, wait.
Well, I have not been one of those who has criticized the so-called fat at North Avenue. I even wrote once, we need to beef up the bureaucracy in the sense that, and it particularly relates back to the classroom. I don't know whether they have the right amount of people in accounting or so forth. I do know that the chief academic officer does not have the resources that she needs to provide the support. Mm-hmm. Principals want support. They want more support than you think. When you talk about decentralization and the autonomy of principals, you need to break that down. Principals need all the autonomy to hire and fire,
exactly.
But they don't need and they shouldn't have the autonomy to choose which particular research programs that, and this goes against sort of the progressive stream in education, but I believe that you have to give them the support to choose and to implement effectively the best research programs out there. You know, in medicine, if you don't follow the research in terms of what are the best medicines, it's called malpractice. In education, it's called autonomy. So, you know, I don't want to pose it as something as an extreme because there, You know, nobody's got all the wisdom in the world, but we need to strike that kind of balance. And again, we need the central staff to be able to provide the training, to be able to do supervision, to be able to do monitoring, to make sure that the dollars are best spent.
Folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. Parents, we want to hear from you, what you think about City Schools, 6 years of Dr. Andres Alonso, community members, and where you think this is, where we've gone the last 6 years, where we have to go, what it might mean with Dr. Tisha Edwards and Sonia Santelis at the kind of managing the school system for the next 6 months at least while they make a choice and make a decision of who's going to be the next CEO. But your thoughts, 410-319-8888. Are they better? Is your child better off in the classroom now than he or she was 6 years ago? Maybe you're married to a teacher. Maybe you are a teacher on break. 410-319-8888. Join us here with your thoughts on this new Maryland Morning Show. And by the way, quick break in here before we do take a break is to let you know that if you were tune in at 9 to know we're making changes and thought I was Sandy Mallory. I'm not. Sandy's on at noon, so she's not going anywhere. She's just on at lunchtime with you rather than coffee break, so you can catch her at noon. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation. We'd love to take your thoughts. I think we'll take a brief break here in just a minute and come right back to our conversation. Don't go away. We're talking about Dr. Andres Alonso's 6 years with our three guests here in the studio, Dr. Ronnie Ellington, Buzzy Hedelman, Erica Green. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us here. The new Mark Steiner Show in the mornings, 9 to 11 a.m. We are tackling Dr. Andres Alonso's tenure as CEO for the last 6 years and what may be coming next and what we're missing, what is the strong points of his administration. 410-319-8888 is number here. We want to hear your thoughts on Dr. Andres Alonso, on your children, on your schools, what you think. 410-319-8888. And on the way to the conversation, remind you to please join us here, by the way, this Thursday, 4 to 7 p.m. here in WEA Studios. Anthony McCarthy, Michelle Martin, or Tommy Moore will be here. I'll be here. An opening reception to introduce you to the new morning lineup. So please join us here 4 to 7 p.m. Meet Michelle Martin and have a lovely few hours just chatting with everybody, meeting everybody, and seeing how our studios work. That's 4 to 7 p.m. this Thursday evening. And you can watch Anthony McCarthy do his stuff live on the air. But right now, be live on the air with us as we talk about Dr. Andres Alonso. In the studio, Erica Green, education reporter for the Baltimore Sun, who's been doing phenomenal reporting on the education system and joins us in studio last. She's always been by phone. Now she's in the studio with us. Dr. Ronnie Ellington is Associate Professor of Mathematics Education here at Morgan State University's School of Education and Urban Studies, Coordinator of the Graduate Programs in Math and Science Education, just appointed to the Community Board, right?
Yeah, Parent Community Advisory Board for Baltimore City.
Baltimore City Schools, for an active now. Parent in our schools. And Buzzy Hedelman, who has served twice on the City School Board, 71 to 74, and brought him back for a second round in 2005, and was on the board that brought Dr. Alonso here to Baltimore. He's been a special education advocate and been working in human services in the state and city for a long, long time. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So as soon as I get the click up there, we'll get to our first caller up. Let's go right to the phones. 410-319-8888. Laurie in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I was just thinking, you know, I heard you're on the air now on EAA after Amy Goodman, Mark, and I thought, you know, I work nights, and I usually take a nap after Amy Goodman, but now I'm going to have to change my sleep schedule. And I thought, oh, once again, you changed my life in ways you don't even know. I was like, you know, I wanted to make a comment because your lineup of guests was so extraordinary today. I want to say as a citizen, I would like to see more real information about what they're calling the school reform movement in our city, specifically the charter school and what I perceive as a takeover of public education. That's just, I mean, it's my opinion. It's not just my opinion. It's a national opinion that public education is under assault by corporate movements, hedge fund managers, all of that stuff, coming in and taking over our public schools. And I see on the ground, I see resegregation. I see people that would not put their kid in a regular neighborhood school, a traditional neighborhood school, but they'll use a boutique charter school. And I don't like what I'm seeing. And I can tell you that I would like to see, and I'm old enough to remember the News American, and when this city had two good newspapers, I would like to see the Baltimore Sun, and to Miss Green, I love your writing. I appreciate what you're doing. And you have an opportunity to really set a high bar as far as objective examination of the school reform movement in this city. And so far, the Baltimore Sun has been letting this lag, I believe. And I'd like to see, for instance, their budgets. I'd like to see how much their CEOs are making. I'd like to see their spin-off foundations, which are paying these people. And I think we are so desperate in this country for journalism to really tell us the truth, And you are the people that are doing that. And we're just waiting. We're waiting to hear the truth. I want to know what their budgets are, these charter schools. I want to know how they have advantages over our traditionally funded public schools. And I am not a fan of privatization. I don't want my postal service privatized, and I don't want my system of public education privatized. But thank you for letting me make my comment. I'll listen to the answer.
I appreciate it, Laura. Thank you. Eric, you want to start first?
I will first say that I agree. I do think I would like to do more work on who is running the schools in the city. I got a chance to do so under this last renewal process for schools that are operated by external operators, from corporations to for-profits to, you know, just community groups that got together to open a good school. I will say budgets are public. You can go get them, mm-hmm. too. and every charter school in the city is also audited, and those are also public information. And I will say, though, in terms of corporations, I mean, at least in the 3 years that I have covered the school system, I haven't seen any big major corporations come in. I would say that Edison Learning, for example, which is a huge national charter operator.
It's lost traction in the city.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They actually got, you know, they had their contract revoked. And another one that is escaping me right now. But I do think there is a very fair point to be made that just as I scrutinize the traditional schools, I would like to do more in scrutinizing who's running our other schools. Another thing in terms of, you know, the funding, I did do a story on that a few years ago. And frankly, the charters are funded under a state negotiated formula that is the law. So they get more cash in lieu of some services that traditional schools, you know, have to pay for, you know, up front, that locked money that, you know. but thank you so much. And I will definitely, you know, more on that.
Let's push this a little further. 410-319-8888, folks. Join me here. I know I see a bunch of questions coming in for Lieutenant Governor. We'll get that. It's not till 10. 410-319-8888.
I understand that.
I want to hear your thoughts on Dr. Andres Alonso and our city schools. Charter schools. I mean, one of the things we've seen with charter schools that all the studies have shown, that charter schools are no better nor worse than a regular conventional schools. And some of them are incredible, but so are some of our regular conventional schools incredible. Mm-hmm. Some of them are miserable and did not do well by our students, as some of our regular city schools have done terribly by our students. So what does that say to you about what direction we're going in? Is charter school something that comes out of a desire for parents and teachers to really run their own schools and education system because they're frustrated? Or is it just one thing people throwing their hands up going, we don't know what else to do, so let's let them in? Buzzy, go ahead.
I think charter schools are a terrific thing. Let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let the good ones keep going. Get rid of the bad ones. But I think I understand the concerns about privatization generally as a political issue, but I think in education that the movement – you can't – a lot of school choice, which is a tremendous strength here now, comes from charter schools and contract schools run by private groups. The problem is that the people nationally, ideologically, who support privatization push it as the end-all, be-all, and refuse to acknowledge that there is another big dimension that is the unspoken word about urban school reform these days, and that is money. Nobody wants to talk about money as being any part of the issue. I believe we need to continue to be more efficient. We need to concentrate on the classroom. But there is an – you're not going to be able to probably move much higher to the next plateau unless we address – the issue of adequate funding. Maryland is probably better than any state in the country at that, but we particularly need money to intervene for struggling readers in the early grades, which is the single most important
We don't have that voice in the air with us today, but there's what we have had in the past and well, in the future, but the conservatives would say we spend enough money already on our schools. How much more can we spend?
Well, they can't show that, because if you look at a school system like Baltimore, we have cut, we have cut, we have cut. Incidentally, one of Dr. Alonzo's great strengths is that he doesn't use money as an excuse, almost to a fault. Principals do it. He's like William Donald Schaefer, don't tell me your problems, just get it done. And that is a strength. But it also requires the additional understanding of where we need the dollars, and we particularly need the dollars to provide the interventions for kids who struggle and fall behind. And I defy any conservative group to show any kind of analysis of where they would now cut funds in an urban school system like Baltimore that is fairly still impoverished.
Now, Ronnie, I know you want to say something about this as well, and because I have another question about charter schools. We have a caller come in. We'll come after Ronnie, though.
Well, yeah, this whole, you know, I think I agree with you. There are some charter schools who are doing great work, and then there are charter schools who are doing what they're doing. But I think the real issue is what are we really up to and what do we value, and how does all of this play out in the experiences of young people, not just in the test scores of young people, because I don't believe young people are data points. That's where we diverge. People are people. And if you ask students what their experience is, and I've asked my daughter, you know, we were at the PCAB meeting and she saw Baltimore City great schools, great something. And
she what said, year is she in?
She's in the seventh grade.
Seventh grade.
And they can be real honest. She said, where's that sign coming from? You know that's not true, Ma. And I said, why you say that? And she said, this is all smoke and mirrors. Now, my daughter is 12 and can identify smoke and mirrors. So I just want to point to that when you talk about those kids' experiences, you know, in Baltimore City, do we feel that the experience in educating our children is getting better? Are our teachers more empowered? Because to me, if you say classroom instruction, you have an empowered teacher, an empowered learner out to create something, right? Is that happening? That's the question. So all the rest of this is great. We got choices. We got charters. We got all of this. But do we have students and teachers in school buildings that have what they need and are provided with the best instruction, and the teachers feel like they can do what they need to do for the students in their room to move these students in the direction? Is that happening? And that's where I think things get dicey. Because I don't think that's always happening. I think people are mandating certain things that may not be appropriate in a particular context, in a school with a teacher and a kid. That's my two cents.
So I have another question.
I don't think it's happening like we think. I think we got data points and we got all this, but we don't have – I go into school buildings and I see what's happening in school buildings. And it's – anyway,
but I'm very sorry. Brief.
Darren, hold on. We're going to come right to your call. But Buzzy, you want to have a quick thought before we go to the phones here?
Writ large, how are we going to know how well we're doing without some data points?
Well, we can. We have both. I'm a qualitative and a quantitative researcher by definition. So, yes, quantitative. I'm a mathematician by training. I can move numbers all kind of places, depending on how you want to move numbers. So we don't want to we can have that off the air. But I'm saying, and as a qualitative researcher, I can see the quality of something by going in and observing what I see and talking to people about their experiences. So both are necessary. Yes, there are numbers, but yes, there are qualitative experiences. And education by definition is a qualitative enterprise, meaning it is people's lives at stake. And that is important. And that's just, I think there should be both. I think we should be looking at both sets of data to really determine if we're moving in the direction we want to.
So I have a question about that, but let me go to the phones first. I'm going to come back to where we left off because it has to do with what we're being left with after Dr. Alonzo leaves and where the leadership may be taking us. 410-319-8888 in this regard. And Darren, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Darren, welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. I want to say that the privatization of schools is problematic. And for many of the reasons that folks have brought out during the discussion, but also because I think the model for education is currently obsolete. We're moving towards a place where we have, Google Glass, and we're going to be able to communicate and experience and access information in ways that we've never been able to. And the structure of current school systems and public and private are not prepared, as well as at the university level, are not prepared to deal with the ways in which people are going to need to be able to creatively access information going forward. And if we don't address that, if we don't lean forward, look far forward enough, that we're not going to be able to, no matter what we do, public or private, we're not going to be able to repair the system.
Darren, you raise a really good point. And I appreciate it. And let me push what you said further, because it feeds in what I was thinking a moment ago. Because what, Buzzy, you said earlier about let 1,000 flowers bloom, which I'm all for, because I was always for the idea that teachers and students should run their own schools. When I was in the city school system and when I was a union rep back in the late 70s, so
go ahead, Mark. I was, and
from that vantage point, I say this: that can you really have alternative forms of education in a city school system, like wealthy people have in our community, where they can pick Gilman, they can pick Friends, they can pick Archbishop Curley, is that still here? Close to him. Anyway, they can pick Bryn Mawr, they can pick Park School. Numbers of private schools. We're flooded with private schools. But those parents have a choice to say, I want my child to have this kind of education. But can we really do that when we're tied to this billion-dollar test industry that's in our school systems across America? That has to teach a certain standard. Like when I asked Governor Martin O'Malley when I was with him at the opening of the session, I said, Governor, you went to Catholic schools. He said, yes, I did. I said, and you graduated from Catholic schools and did really well. He said, yes, they were great education. I said, did you all have to take standardized tests to judge how teachers did? The answer was no.
Mm.
So are we missing something here in terms of reform, both in terms of money that we need for our schools, because poor kids clearly need a great deal more than kids of means in terms of being able to create a system that works? So are we really missing anything? Are we missing kind of a key element here in this conversation?
Well, that was my point around the qualitative, like really knowing, like I've seen some charter schools who on paper, their data looks the same as other schools. But when I go in their schools, they are much better in climate. There's a lot else going on that the numbers don't capture. And then I've seen some people who look good on paper and you go in the school and it's chaotic and crazy. And I'm just saying that we need to really balance out this whole data. I tell people, most people don't even know how to read the data they're getting to make assess. So anyway, there's a whole world that we've created around data that I think needs to be rethought, that's not necessarily accurate. And as a mathematician, I love, like anybody else, to use numbers to predict and tell me stuff. But I know the limitations of data because I understand the assumptions on which they're built. So those assumptions don't necessarily match on to schooling. And that's what I don't think we're getting, because people are not numbers, period. They are people. And until we start dealing with both, yes, there's some numbers you can gather as data, but you also have people who have experiences and lives and heartbeats that we have to consider, teachers as well as students as well as principals. So that's just, I'm going to get off the soapbox with that.
And
yeah.
Well, I just wanted to say that, that's where – the charter conversation comes in, you know, this data versus experience. And it was really eye-opening for me, even as a reporter, going through the recent charter renewal process where, you know, there were these presentations and it was, well, their scores have not moved in 3 years. And, they're, you know, for example, Bluford Jude Jemison.
I was going to leave that alone.
Yeah, you know, that's a school that they I walked into the room and a young man immediately got up and gave me his seat. You know, and it was yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. And those kids were there fighting for their school to stay open.
This is the one on the east side, right?
Yes. East.
The all-boys middle school.
Middle school. And if you look at them on paper, you're like, ugh, what is going on there?
But
when I met that young man and he looked me straight in my eye, I said, oh, that's
there's something special going on in that school that was not being taken
into account. Was not being captured by these data points that we keep pointing to.
The only school in Baltimore that taught Latin.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that's the kind of – it was the experience that the parents were fighting for.
Before we go back to the phones, Buzz, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Look, the underlying issue here is who's going to make the decisions about what is a good school and what is not a good school.
The parents and the teachers.
Well
– they got some say. That's my opinion.
They should have some say, but where is the accountability going to be? And at root here, we're back to the issue of No Child Left Behind and testing. And let's say that there are all kinds of problems with testing and the reliance on testing. But there needs to be a balance.
What's the alternative? There's a balance.
Before testing, there was no accountability.
But nobody's suggesting that.
No accountability for the performance of minority kids, poor kids, and students with disabilities. And so how are we going to strike that balance?
And that's the point I was making.
That's the tough question.
Going all the way to the left is not the way to balance either. So that's what I'm saying. That was my whole point about using a conglomerate of quote-unquote data to make those decisions. And if parents really believe in a school in a way that says, regardless of this, I want my son here, that matters. That should matter. That's all I'm saying. In addition to all the – I think you should look at it in a holistic way, and it should be done in a case-by-case basis. That's my point. It's not a one-size-fit-all, it's this or you're gone type of situation.
Let me go back to the phone. I promise to get the listeners back in here. And also let me just say that Archbishop Curley is still open. Our very competent engineer,
good.
Andrea Milton, is a Morgan
thing.
Grad, but also is a graduate of Archbishop Curley and says he got an incredible education there. That should be a show in itself. What did City Schools missing when Andrew Melton saying that he got a great education at Archbishop Curley? Doing something there we're not doing here. That's another day. 410-319-8888. Doug Colbert, you're on the air. Welcome, Doug.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Very well. Welcome.
Thank you very much for your wonderful panel. And I do want to address the speakers who are talking about a holistic view and also the comments about needing more money. And I want to try to... Well, I want to ask the question, but also make the comment as to why we're not making the connection between the money that always seems to be available to incarcerate our young people and to deprive them of continuing at school with the difficulty of adding money to our school system that would lead to a much more quality education. And I say that in the context of I see, you know, young people, young African Americans in particular, both boys and girls, but predominantly it's the boys who are in jail on and these are relatively minor crimes, but they're in jail because they can't afford the bail money. And when they're in jail, they miss weeks of school. When they miss weeks of school, you could just imagine what it would be like if our children missed a day of school. But here are kids who are in jail, you know, charged with something like possessing marijuana or, you know, or disorderly conduct or something that normally doesn't require jail before trial. I'm just wondering whether it's even possible to think that schools and teachers and principals might respond when one of their children are in jail and be able to come forward and speak, send a letter or speak to a judge and say, Judge, this person should be back in school, and if you release the person, I certainly will, you know, do everything I can to make sure the person returns. I think that's a connection that would decrease the local jail population and allow kids to continue receiving the education that they need.
That's a very, very powerful point, and also seems to me a topic for an entire conversation, which we'll have Doug on for. Any thoughts on that?
Well, again, Dr. Alonzo is far from perfect, but he's done as much as anyone to make clear that the schools are not supposed to be expelling and suspending these students without trying and trying and trying to deal with their problems there. The other thing, of course, that's at the root of what Doug is saying, it is that we really don't know how much the schools can do by themselves now because of the larger social and economic forces there that are impeding families and children's early development. But we can do a heck of a lot better. But no one, again, quite knows how far we can go.
I know. I have teacher friends who have actually bailed their students out of jail.
Who have bailed their students. See,
absolutely.
Again, we never give our teachers credit for that kind of
yep,
stuff
exactly.
either.
Yeah, that's not on
absolutely.
A data point. That's not
right.
a data point.
They're not evaluated.
I fed the kid. I
not.
Supported them. I went to their absolutely. Home to have conversations with their parents. I know teachers who are doing things that no data
above
point can
beyond.
Capture. So that's why holistic evaluations to me work, because then people can bring that in as a way to say, this is a quality school that I want to see flourish.
And when you
I'm done. I'm off my soapbox, but this is a big one for me, because to
that's
me empowering teachers and parents, because they're the ones in the school and they know.
Mm-hmm.
They have something else to say that data points don't capture. And that should be a part that should be no less valuable than your quote unquote data point.
And that's, to Alonzo's credit, he has, you know, preached that since he got here, that you bring kids back by any means necessary.
He has done that.
They belong
and
with us.
Put his money where his mouth is by starting the school at North Avenue.
Absolutely.
Yes, right.
And instead of having kids thrown out of school, he's done that. And I think that's really an important step, because it is. These are the kids, when you're dealing with an urban school system with high poverty rate, if you don't take into account the kids who are really on the edge, keeping them from going over the edge, then we're also not doing our job. That's part of money. It takes money to have a wraparound school system.
That's right.
It takes money to do that. 410-319-8888. Sharon, you're on the air. Hey, Sharon, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thank you so much for including me in this conversation. I really can't say that I disagree with any of the things that your folks are saying about the need to meet these students where they are. I am really concerned about the accountability factors that your panelist was talking about. There are really easy ways to say we are making progress, and I would love to hear about if we're meeting them where they're at. You can measure, for example, if a kid comes in and they're reading at the third grade level and they're in high school, and you let that teacher know that's where they're at, and they make a year's growth. You celebrate that, and you give them those services in the classroom, and they don't need to be a part of special education to have that. So that's number one. And number two, we have to build our communities. I heard a lot of conversation about the charters and why the climate is so often different. They work with the parents. They work with a community base. And having worked in both traditional school and in the charter school situations, when you have those partnerships and you have that buy-in, it isn't necessarily tied to budget.
We have about 2 minutes left. And we're talking budget. Buzzy, let me a quick thought. On what our
I think
was saying,
we largely agree that we need a combination of quantitative and qualitative measures, and we need a combination of doing better with the money we have and getting more money that will enable us to do more. There is no easy, you know.
What would happen if the next CEO or the CEO, interim CEO, did what the Montgomery County superintendent is doing, which is saying we're going to have a moratorium on tests.
Lord,
on
thank
testing.
You, Jesus. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to say that. I'm sorry.
No,
back it up. That's not this day. I'm sorry.
But that
that is that's only partially anti-testing. It also is a whole nother conversation, which is the Common Core, which is raising the bar and is going to dramatically cause discomfort, if not upheaval, in the short run. So that's a different issue than throwing testing out altogether.
Well, I think we should do an hour on Common Core. We could come back and do that in a regular conversation on this. I think we're just about running out of time here. I want to thank all of our callers for calling in. I want to thank our guests here, Dr. Ronnie Ellington, professor of education here at Morgan State University, math education, coordinator of the graduate program of math and science education, and a parent activist in the schools and part of the community
parent community advisory board. There is a parent community advisory board for Baltimore City Schools.
And
yes.
Ronnie's on that. Erica Green, education reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Please don't be a stranger and join us. Not you know how to get here and which building is which.
Exactly,
it's difficult to tell on this campus when you drive down Perry Park which building is which. But you made it, which is good to have you here. Buzzy Handelman, thank you so much. And
you'll come
back as well
as
we continue these conversations, as we will, about education and the future of education. We're going to take a very brief break. And when we return, we'll be joined by the Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, who has just announced his candidacy for governor. We're joining us here for the next half an hour, so stay with us. Don't go anywhere. Mark Steiner Show here in the morning.